Welcome to Consider the Constitution, the podcast that cuts through the noise and provides insight into constitutional issues that directly affect every American. Hosted by Dr. Katie Crawford Lackey and featuring interviews with constitutional scholars, policy and subject matter experts, heritage professionals, and legal practitioners, we examine the rights and responsibilities of citizenship. Consider the Constitution is brought to you by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
Hello, and welcome back to Consider the Constitution. I'm your host, Dr. Katie Crawford Lackey, Director of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Law enforcement officers pledge to defend and uphold the U.S. Constitution and are responsible for maintaining public safety. In a field that's heavily scrutinized, is highly stressful, and often dangerous, having a strong constitutional foundation is important. Creating this foundation involves exploring the history of policing, of civil rights, and constitutional change, and how public safety and punishment disparately affect different communities, especially communities of color. Joining us for a discussion on the origins and development of policing and police-community relations in America is Dr. Deanza Cook, Assistant Professor of Contemporary African American History and Black Leadership at The Ohio State University. Her research specializes in race, social reform, and American law enforcement during and after the Civil Rights Movement. Dr. Cook's writing on criminalization and law enforcement in America's past and present is featured in Metropole, Black Perspectives, an annual review of criminology. Dr. Cook, it's so wonderful to have you with us. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, when we think about the early history of policing in America, this is a field that has evolved significantly since the 16 and 1700s when law enforcement was more decentralized and informal, with towns and communities implementing their own systems. And this was often done on a volunteer basis. So if we keep in mind that James Madison was born in 1751 and from his infancy was raised here at Montpelier in Orange County, Virginia, he didn't participate in the drafting of the U.S. Constitution until the 1780s. So this is a span of time when we don't have this founding document guiding what law enforcement and policing looked like in the colonies and then eventually in very early America. Can you tell us a bit about what this looked like in terms of what was happening with policing in the colonial period?
Absolutely. So policing was in development, right? It was an experiment of sorts, trying to figure out what formation, what institution of public safety could be created out of the human populations that were living there to perform not just law enforcement and order maintenance functions that are traditionally tied to policing, but to perform basic municipal functions, to provide what we would today probably regard as a social service or social work, and to do kind of fees collection, taxes, weather announcements, taking care of lighting lampposts, helping out with fire safety. There were a lot of different jobs that folks who were a part of night watches and city guards, who were a part of constables, who were sheriffs, they were working on the local level to try to create a sense of order, right? A sense of peace. And within the English settler colonies prior to the 1780s, when the Constitution was ratified and then put into effect in 1789, there still were laws that existed on the local level because of the colonial government structures. They had local laws. And some of those laws, because we're talking about the 17th and 18th century, were explicitly tied to slavery and settler colonization. We had slave laws. We had Indian laws. And these sorts of laws had explicit directives about law enforcement. They authorized in the southern colonies, starting in Virginia and the Carolinas, North Carolina and South Carolina, they attributed legal authority to what they called slave patrollers, who were authorized by magistrates, local judges, county courts, to perform law enforcement work on plantations, to perform law enforcement work in surrounding areas. So they were patrolling on plantation roads in between these large, vast landscapes and patrolling in urban cities as well, right? This is countrysides and in the urban landscape. And so these systems, local colonial legal systems, were already starting to create what we would now call patrol forces. Even though they weren't necessarily bureaucratized in the way that we would recognize them today as departments, they were formal systems, right? They had legal authority, they had credibility, they had regulations. Some of these men on slave patrols were paid in kind through tobacco or through tax write-offs. Some of them were actually paid in actual money at the time. And these laws weren't just exclusive to folks who were actively practicing slavery and settler colonialism. Even as early as 1631 in Boston with the Boston Night Watch, they were creating formations of men who were recruited from the community to go out on patrol at night. And explicitly in the court order, they were to be on the lookout for a crime of all sorts, including from free blacks, enslaved blacks, because we know that Massachusetts had sanctioned slavery in 1641, as well as Native Americans, who they also saw as a threat to their social order. So even before the Constitution had come into being, there were already legal infrastructures in place to create the predecessors of police departments that we recognize today.
I think it's fascinating that while we don't have this legal framework of the U.S. Constitution setting these guidelines for law enforcement, as you've described, there are still structures in place, often at the local level, that are guiding what these officials should be doing. And as you mentioned, possibly these people they should be looking out for. And it sounds like that was very specific. When we think about the Constitution, De'Anza, and how it changes what law enforcement look like, what is the big takeaway from what the Constitution does in terms of law enforcement and how it evolves?
Yeah, so what the Constitution does is it legitimizes the police powers of the state, and not just with the Constitution, but more specifically with the 10th Amendment. It confers those police powers to the states. What the states are then able to do are construct state constitutions. And in those state constitutions, legal scholars like Rachel Harmon remind us that police officers are creatures of those state laws. State legislatures are empowered to create and fund police departments. And so we can't neglect the importance of the Constitution in affirming that police officers are creatures of state law, they are constituted by law, and that states have the legal authority constitutionally to have some form of public safety that is available to residents and citizens in their localities.
So you talk a bit about slave patrols and kind of how people who were enslaved were watched and kind of reinforcing the bondage and their behaviors. How does that change post-Civil War? How does law enforcement change after people are emancipated? Do slave patrols become bygone system of the past, or do we see similarities that carry through to modern policing?
Yeah, so police history shows us that the formalization of police departments, and what I mean by that is we actually see cities creating full-time agencies, so no longer are these volunteer folks, they are full-time employees, right, paid by the state through our taxes, and with the full-fledged authority to perform law enforcement actions with uniforms and badges, right? Those are also reforms that, on a side note, police officers didn't like. They didn't want to wear uniforms and badges because they felt like it would be too similar to European occupation and the use of military. And so they wanted to avoid that. But part of the early kind of professionalization of policing was creating these agencies of law enforcement workers, still very much mired in politics, right? These political machines who are running cities are also in charge of who staffs those police departments, right? They handpick who gets to be their commissioner or who serves on the board of police directors. And so policing and politics are interwoven in terms of its formation. And so as the Civil War is progressing, and even honestly prior to as a settlement, and the U.S. is expanding westward, and as there are increasing threats from, at least from the perspective of the colonists, from Native Americans who are fighting back to keep their lands, creating these police forces was also a part of shoring up what we would now call national security. Also, too, folks in the antebellum period were well aware that the country was not in a good place, right? And so with slavery being such a huge national dilemma, the sense of needing security mobilized a lot of cities across the states to have these formal systems. Now, after the Civil War, when radical Reconstruction is in place and federal occupation in the South is in full force, we see major transformations in the South where Black men who are recruited to staff police departments to assist Union soldiers and freedmen workers and folks who are trying to actualize constitutional freedoms newly acquired by virtue of the Reconstruction Amendments. And so we see a transformation where there's new space within the law enforcement profession for African-American men, at least, to be a part of that. That comes crashing to a halt with the demise of Reconstruction in 1877. Once federal occupation ends and federal leniency on what the state constitutions and local laws look like in the New South, it creates not only a vacuum for Jim Crow laws and black codes to be codified on the local level, which we know, of course, curtailed all of those wonderful constitutional freedoms that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment tried to provide for newly freed black people. So those black policemen during the radical Reconstruction era are purged from police forces. And the ones who are able to maintain employment, mostly in northern and western cities where Jim Crow laws were at least not on the books and where de facto segregation was existing, police officers, policemen, and a handful of policewomen in the early 1900s had to participate in segregated units. They were required to police only people who looked like them. And we're not just talking about racial segregation, we're also talking about gender segregation. So when women were recruited to the police force, they were also staffed on police women's units, right? And they were performing gender-specific duties like catering to youth and women and families. So there is a lot that we can talk about when it comes to how policing changed after the Civil War. But what we do know is that the folks who had been a part of a policing slavery, who had been a part of slave patrols, who had been a part of enforcing the Fugitive Slave Act, those are the folks who were recruited to staff police departments. Police departments in the late 19th century are overwhelmingly white men, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, but also white ethnics who are coming in. There are Irish and German men who are staffing police departments, especially in the North and in places like Buffalo, New York, for example. And so we see this brief moment where there could have been an opportunity for a black freedman, at least, to change policing. But that is shortchanged by the Compromise of 1877 and this retreat to Jim Crow and legal segregation, which, of course, affects policing.
One of the challenges I find in studying history is that oftentimes we remember it as kind of a story of progress, when in reality, there were often, you know, a step forward and two steps back. And I think the history of Reconstruction is part of that, at least for myself, was aware that, you know, that was a period after the Civil War when black men had greater opportunities in terms of serving in politics. But I hadn't considered what that meant in terms of black men and perhaps women even being able to serve in law enforcement. And it sounds like that was a period where there was greater ability not only to be involved in the field, but also work alongside in integrated work settings. Whereas later, as you mentioned, during Jim Crow, this is not the case. You know, those Reconstruction era, that progress is repealed in a way. And now we have those who can serve in law enforcement are segregated by gender, for example. So this is, I think, an important example of how this story, in this case in law enforcement, is one that is nuanced and complex.
Yes, absolutely.
And again, it's important when we think about the civil rights movement, that's not the first time that people were advocating for greater civil rights to be involved in different fields. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, what was the dynamic between folks who were trying to bring recognition that they were entitled to these rights and what was happening with law enforcement in the 1950s and 60s?
The problem of police brutality has always been a core component of the Black freedom struggle. African Americans, people of African descent, experienced forms of law enforcement that were not intended to serve or protect them. And during the civil rights movements, Black Power movements, there were constant clashes between protesters and police. And we see, moving into the 60s, especially with Black rebellions, and I use the term Black rebellions, hearkening to Elizabeth Hinton's work, because these were political actions, right? The political violence was a core part of what was going on in these cities because of the fact that negative encounters with police, violent encounters with law enforcement were often the impetus for a lot of the violence that took place in the late 60s and continued throughout the late 20th century, because we know that Rodney King in 1991, right? There's a long durée in African-American history of police brutality serving as an impetus for political rebellion. And that is certainly the case during the mid-20th century. Civil rights activists were having to confront not just police during protests, but also being jailed. We often forget that Dr. Martin Luther King was jailed at least over 30 times throughout the course of his activist life. And, you know, he's definitely not an anomaly. There are lots of narratives and accounts of civil rights activists and Black Power activists being incarcerated for their activism. And so what these groups were trying to push for was an end to police brutality, an end to the idea that Black criminality or that Black inferiority should be justification for the premature death of Black people. They wanted to live in environments where they felt like they weren't being surveilled by an occupying force. They wanted the American dream to be a reality. They wanted to feel like their constitutional freedoms would be respected and respected by the people in highest authority, and especially respected by people who had a badge and a gun. And so some of the things that civil rights activists and community residents in areas where harm and violence were rampant, they pushed for changes in policing. They initially, some folks advocated that we should change police recruitment. We should recruit more people of color. We should recruit more women. We should recruit people who speak different languages. We should recruit people who have an affinity for the communities that you all are more likely to be in to perform your law enforcement actions. But some of those activists said that we actually should push for more, right? That this system of policing wasn't actually made for us, right? Like, we were the objects of police, right? We were the targets of police. It was enshrined in law. And so this idea that we can reinvent a system that was never meant for us to be integrated within it was ludicrous. And some folks said that we should push for something completely different, something that will actually bring public safety to our communities in a way that is conducive for us and conducive for our livelihoods.
It really resonates with me when you talk about kind of the different perspectives on how do we better address the dynamic between law enforcement and communities today. And yes, there are aspects like diversity within the force, people of color, women, how they're interacting with communities. But then there's also this layer about the system itself and what's working and what isn't. And when we think about policing today, how do we as community members kind of forge a better relationship with law enforcement?
So Black police reformers who start entering into the police profession en masse in the 1960s and 70s and continuing with the help of affirmative action policies and consent decrees advocated for a new approach to policing that we now refer to as community policing. And what these police reformers like Lee Patrick Brown, Hubert Williams, Elsie Scott, these folks were pushing for reorientation of how the police not only perform their work in practice out on the streets, neighborhoods and schools, wherever police are operating, but also how police administered themselves, right? They had a vision, a new vision for police administration, a new vision for how police understood their philosophy and approach to the work that they were doing. What that vision was all about was about including the community. It was about creating visible, transparent, and consistent connections with the community members who officers were charged with encountering and engaging with. They felt like ideals such as participatory democracy, community engagement, public accountability, and power sharing were essential for not only rebuilding trust and confidence in policing from historically oppressed communities who did not see the police as a part of their community, but also to re-educate law enforcement officers who were predominantly white men about the importance of building relationships that are mutually beneficial, that are built on mutual trust, and how essential that is to actually effectively creating public safety. Now, those guys like Lee Patrick Brown were writing about community policing in the late 1980s, and it becomes this big thing in the 1990s when President Clinton signs the 1994 crime bill, creates a whole agency dedicated to pumping out community-oriented policing services across the country. And of course, as we know, with big ideas, once they are bureaucratized, they sometimes get watered down and mired in politics. And that's what happens with the concept of community policing. Its philosophy becomes part of a larger mania over super predators and over rising reported rates of harm and violence and of death by gun-related or drug-related or gang-related incidences. And this idea of working with the community becomes very narrow. Who counts as community becomes very narrow. Who's able to actually partner with police becomes narrow. And so we've now found ourselves 50 years later, after we've kind of experimented with this community policing idea. And now you could probably Google most any police department and they'll tell you in their motto that they're doing some spin of community policing. And so activists who are students of abolition of slavery, students of Jim Crow, students of the Black rebellions, of the civil rights and Black power movements, see the ways in which even Black police reformers tried to eradicate injustices within the institution and have been met with resistance, structural barriers. You know, some folks have left the profession entirely because of their inability to actualize the change that they wanted to see. And the consistent cycle of police brutality that continued in the early 20th and the early 21st century with the rise of Black Lives Matter, with the 2020 uprisings that just happened, activists are growing increasingly disenchanted and disengaged with this idea that community policing can actually be fully effective for all of us. And so what folks are looking to now is not just, you know, how can we perfect community policing? How can we actually make it a part of what police do? But some folks are saying, how can we imagine public safety on the community level outside of having to rely on state authorities and people who are armed? What does the community want to see when it comes to public safety and policing? And that looks different for every locality. Some folks just want their officers to do their jobs better. And some folks want there to be other agencies that they can go to for mental health crises, for family issues, for domestic issues that don't necessarily involve the legal system because of their apprehensions, because of their cynicism toward the system being able to help them, and because the system itself, in some people's minds, is illegitimate. And we got to contend with that. We live in a democracy. We got to persuade people that policing is actually a public good. You can't take that for granted, because to some folks, policing isn't a public good to them. And so some communities are trying to imagine public safety without police in prisons. And they're trying to do that by mobilizing the resources within the community that they have, by amplifying opportunities for mutual aid, by implementing restorative and transformative justice spaces and programs, and educating other people in their community about what people power can look like, empowering the community to create and actualize public safety among themselves in a way that's consistent with what the community needs.
You touch on so many important points. And one of the biggest takeaways for me is that kind of addressing this relationship between members of the community and law enforcement really requires all of us to have a vested interest, requires all of us to be engaged in participating, both officers themselves, but people within their communities, as you said, you know, sharing resources and identifying through self-reflection, where am I at? How am I bringing my thoughts, my history, my feelings to this? And then another important piece that I kind of hear is this perspective getting in terms of actually engaging with other people and understanding where they're coming from, understanding community needs. How do we take those resources in a community and use it for the benefit of all? That's, I think, a common goal for all of us is better public safety and better relationships between all people.
Absolutely. We see the reality that harm and violence is real. It has extreme effects, and even more so on the people who are at the margins of our society. And so this isn't about destroying opportunities to protect people. It's about building ones that actually work for the people who are in most need of protection, and creating systems that don't encourage us to disengage, but encourage us to be aware, right? That's what public safety is all about. We can't make our communities whole without all of us being a part of that, keeping that community whole.
And I think that's such an important conversation as we wrap up today. To continue forward, it's about these shared goals that we have and trying to reach them collectively.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cook, for being with us today. I really appreciate you sharing your knowledge and your insights. I am certainly going to take away a lot from this conversation and get engaged in my own community myself. So thank you.
That sounds wonderful, Katie. Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
And I want to thank all of our listeners today. I hope you'll share the show with your friends and family. And join us again in 2 weeks for Consider the Constitution.